of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just a second.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Wednesday, June 7th, 2011, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Among the Truthers, a journey through America's growing conspiracist underground. We'll spend the hour with journalist and author Jonathan Kay.
Sorry if my eyes drop when the bellow meadows out, but I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. The internet has been abuzz for some weeks now about a NASA cover-up of a prediction that in 2012 the sun will erupt in a solar flare so dangerous that it could destroy the Earth. While solar astronomers have assured the public that our sun is a very stable star, incapable of generating a flare strong enough to engulf the Earth, it has done little to assuage the online hysteria that such stories often generate. In fact, the internet has played a significant role in the past decade or so of helping to proliferate all manner of conspiracy theories about various incidents and events, chief among them the September 11th conspiracy and the Obama birth certificate conspiracy. A new book by blogger and journalist Jonathan Kay paints a complex and deeply revealing portrait of today's conspiracy movements, particularly the so-called truthers and birthers. Jonathan Kay spent 2 years attending conventions, perusing chat rooms, websites and Facebook groups, and interviewing key members of conspiracy movements. His book, Among the Truthers, A Journey Through America's Growing Conspiracist Underground, makes the connection between the general distrust that a majority of Americans have of their government and the real and documented crimes and cover-ups in history that provide fodder for conspiracies. Kay also takes issue with his own profession and the mainstream media's failure to respond to accusations of pro-government bias. He approaches conspiracy theories connected to both ends of the political spectrum from his self-described position of political centrism. Jonathan Kay is managing editor, columnist, and blogger at Canada's National Post newspaper. His freelance articles have appeared in such publications as The New Yorker, The New York Times, Harper's Magazine, Commentary, Salon, Reader's Digest, and Newsweek. We're going to spend the hour today speaking with Jonathan Kay about his book, Among the Truthers. He now joins me on the phone. Welcome to Uprising, Jonathan Kay.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start by asking you about your first impressions of the people that you began interacting with who call themselves 9/11 truthers, who you say you found to be surprisingly respectful and quite intelligent.
Yeah. Before embarking on this project, I had the usual stereotype of conspiracy theorists, which was that antisocial, unhinged loners. And I think there was a day when that stereotype was true, but in the internet era, these people tend to be well-connected, very technologically savvy. Often they're computer experts, or they have jobs, other kinds of white-collar jobs. They usually are highly articulate. They're used to expressing themselves by email and on blogs and making videos and that sort of thing. So they come across a lot more professional and impressive than conspiracy theorists from past generations. And that's how I became interested in the phenomenon, because these were people who had the skills to take part in a mainstream political discourse, and I didn't like the effect they were having on that discourse.
So let's talk about the history of conspiracism in the United States before we get into today's main conspiracies and some of the cast of characters that you cover in your book. There is a history here in the United States that you cite which has three major influences, one of them being apocalyptic millennialism. And, you know, there might be a lot of people who consider themselves 9/11 truthers who might think, well, I'm not someone who, I don't even know what apocalyptic millennialism means. So how does the religious history of the United States relate to the history of conspiracism here?
Well, since its founding, the United States has been a religious Christian country. And in recent generations, it has been also an evangelical one. And in the evangelical Christian tradition, there's a strong emphasis on the conflict between good versus evil, not just in men's souls, but on a sort of cosmic level, borrowing from the book of Revelation. And this this idea of good versus evil plays out in all kinds of dramatic ways. The Left Behind book series, which became very popular in the last couple of decades, is one of them. And it lends itself to the idea that the Antichrist is marshaling his forces in all sorts of seen and unseen ways. And evangelical Christians often spend a lot of time analyzing news headlines for signs of the Antichrist approaching and this great coming conflict between Jesus and the Antichrist. And this plays out in a secular way with conspiracy theories, because many conspiracy theories follow the same script, the idea that there is some kind of dark, conspiratorial, antichrist-type force that is moving to take over American society. Now, this has become part of the American political DNA, and many of the people who are influenced by this, they might not actually be themselves religious, but it has become part of the secular American tradition just because it's been going on for so long. And you don't see it as much in Europe. There are other influences in Europe. We could talk about that maybe a little later, but in the United States, evangelical Christianity has been a major influence on the shaping of conspiracism.
And then also the sort of history of populism in the United States, you say, plays a big role in how we see conspiracism in the United States. Can you relate that a little bit?
Well, this goes all the way to America's founding. America was founded in revolution against a very real foreign power, which patriotic Americans thought was oppressive. And because that was the way America was created, there has been this vigilance in American political culture, which, by the way, in many cases is a good thing, a vigilance against any kind of foreign plots or conspiracies to overthrow the United States or to infiltrate the halls of power in Washington. And this is a vigilance that continues to the current day. There's always, you always hear of people accusing so-and-so of a communist plot or trying to implement Sharia in this or that part of the United States. And this is taken form in many ways. Anti-Catholic conspiracy theories, anti-Mason conspiracy theories, the Illuminati. There were some anti-Semitic conspiracy theories in the United States, although I hasten to mention that anti-Semitic conspiracy theories were much more popular in Europe than in the United States. The United States has been much less anti-Semitic than its European equivalents. But as I say, this is part of the tradition of a country that was born in revolution and that to this day remains very, very skeptical of foreigners coming and taking over the country. In the 19th century, this took the form of conspiracy theories about foreign bankers and gold merchants from Britain who were trying to control the American economy. And you still see some of that, some shades of that in the response to the 2008 financial crisis. These are themes that have been repeating themselves for two centuries in American public life.
And then finally, the third influence that you cite as being really important in terms of looking at conspiracy theories in the U.S. is the advent of technology. And near the end of your book, in fact, you talk about how the Internet has really enabled so much more cross-proliferation and cross-pollination of some of these many, many varying threads of conspiracy theories. Is this something that you see unique to the United States, or does it have an influence worldwide?
Well, technology comes in two ways. The first way is much more recent, the Internet and the way that conspiracy theorists communicate, and that's a global phenomenon. The way that technology affects American conspiracism in a more particularly American way is more of a mid-20th century phenomenon, and that's because of the rapid technological progress that the United States exhibited in the middle part of the 20th century, where all sorts of new technologies came on very suddenly: surveillance technologies, computers, invasive medical imaging, nuclear technology. These are technologies that have been applied all over the world, but because of America's extremely rapid rate of technological development, their onset was much more pronounced in the United States. And in the space of just a couple of decades, around World War II, the years before and the years after, America became a very scary place very quickly for Americans. People who grew up in the horse and buggy era suddenly were confronted with things like jet airplanes and computers and rockets. And that's when you started to see massive suspicion of technology among American conspiracy theorists. Fluoridation became a major obsession of conspiracy theorists. Surveillance equipment, the idea that computers were being installed in our bodies or in our houses to monitor us. Concerns about the air we breathe and electromagnetic radiation. The idea that we were always being watched everywhere. And again, like many conspiracy theories, there's a grain of truth to this because, for instance, the government can monitor our movements based on our cell phone signals. I mean, that's true. It's not a conspiracy theory. But this rapid onset of technology in the 20th century produced a lot of fear among ordinary Americans, and they started to regard all technology as suspect, and they began to weave fears of it into their conspiracy theories.
Now, let's talk about some of the major theories. Before we get into the 9/11 truth movement, let's talk about the conspiracy theory that came before that had the most traction, and that was the conspiracy around the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And you say that there are a lot of parallels with these two theories, and there's a lot of truthers who hold the same beliefs about the conspiracy that JFK's assassination was somehow orchestrated by the government. What exactly are, you know, can you tell us a little bit about how the JFK conspiracy remains alive today in so many ways?
Sure. Well, the major way it remains alive is in the way that it reflects massive distrust toward government. Different people have different theories about how JFK was killed, but the most interesting and important and enduring aspect of it was to me that these same people also attacked the integrity of the Warren Commission, and they doubted that the Warren Commission was actually looking for the truth and was telling Americans the truth. And that is a huge accusation to make against a group of public officials, the idea that some of the most important people in America are systemically lying to Americans. And this is something that would have been unthinkable a couple of decades before when people had greater faith in government. And the idea that the most important people in the United States are lying to citizens in order to cover up some horrible crime, this has become an enduring theme in conspiracism, and it reflects the lack of trust people have in their government, which is a relatively new phenomenon. It's only been going on for about 4 or 5 decades historically. And it's the same thing that you see in the response to 9/11. When I interviewed conspiracy theorists about the 9/11 Commission, and I say, well, why do you believe these conspiracy theories when they were debunked by the 9/11 Commission? They simply assume that the members of the 9/11 Commission were part of the same corrupt, lying establishment, that they're lackeys of George Bush and Dick Cheney, the very same people who, in their imagination, blew up the World Trade Center. So it's the same toxic distrust of government that applies in both cases.
You say in your book, something in the human mind rebels at the notion that famous people can be felled by lone assassins, accidents, a drug overdose, or suicide. How much of the JFK conspiracy is seen in parallels with the deaths of other famous people?
Well, yes, this does seem to be a very important psychological idea that, as you say, great people just simply don't die by accident. They have to die in great or epic ways. And you don't just see this with JFK. You know, in JFK, everyone assumed that it was part of some huge international plot. And you also see it even with people like Marilyn Monroe. There's all kinds of conspiracy theories about her. Princess Diana is another example. To this day, you will find lots of websites, people claiming that it was a Mossad conspiracy. Kurt Cobain, lead singer for the band Nirvana, people refuse to believe that he committed suicide. They imagine that it was some kind of murder plot. Or people instead fantasize that these people are still alive. Elvis, Jim Morrison, these are all examples of the same phenomenon.
I want to go even further back. I'm sort of putting off the discussion about 9/11 truth for just a little bit longer. You say that in your book that so much of the stories around and the mythologies that conspiracy theorists build starts at the protocols of the learned elders of Zion. And I have to admit, this is something that I've sort of seen mentioned often and have not really read a history about it till I saw your book. So share that with our listeners. And this is an inherently anti-Semitic theory.
Well, the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion is an infamous anti-Semitic hoax that was produced by Tsarists, Russian Tsarists, about 90 years ago. in the early part of the 20th century, and it gained wide circulation around Europe right after World War I and the Russian Revolution, and it blamed all the world's problems on Jews. Wars, depressions, pornography, alcoholism, every sin you can imagine was blamed on Jews. It was a preposterous anti-Semitic fable, but people believed it because Europe at the time was traumatized and they were looking for a scapegoat, and the Jews became the scapegoat. And it went on to inspire the Nazis, and it led to the death of millions of Jews. And people today don't read it, and the reason they don't read it is because we know it's a complete hoax and it's wrong and it's hateful. However, I read it because I was doing research on conspiracy theories, and this is one of the oldest and most important conspiracy theories. And what I found was, and what I was shocked to find, was that the basic structure of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is to say, blaming a small, secretive group of people for all of the world's problems, is the basic structure of pretty much every conspiracy theory that has emerged since then. And I step readers through, in my book, I step readers through step by step the different components of this conspiracy theory, because there are many components. However, I hasten to say, that is not to say that all modern conspiracy theories are anti-Semitic. I don't believe that modern conspiracy theories generally are anti-Semitic. Some are, but most aren't. What I mean to say is that the basic structure of the conspiracy theory remains the same.
And do conspiracy theorists today take this hoax seriously, or has it been discredited even among them?
I think for most it's been discredited, but what they simply do is they change the names. They say, oh, it's not the Jews, it's the Freemasons, it's the Illuminati, it's the New World Order, or they say it's the Bilderbergers, that's Bilderberger being a transatlantic group that is an obsession among conspiracy theorists. So what they do is they say, oh, yes, we distance ourselves from this anti-Semitic nonsense, but if you just change the name of Jew to Bilderberger or whatnot, that's where you get to the truth. Because so they just keep the same structure of the conspiracy theory. They just apply it to some different group.
I'm speaking with Jonathan Kay. He is a journalist, a managing editor, a columnist and blogger at Canada's National Post newspaper. And his book that we're discussing is called Among the Truthers, A Journey Through America's Growing Conspiracist Underground. So let's get to the 9/11 theory. I was surprised to learn in your book that you spent a lot of time with 9/11 truthers and had a difficult time to trying to pin down what their main theory is, what the main prevailing storyline of what the truthers believe really happened on 9/11 is. Isn't there some sort of timeline of events that they claim happened?
Well, in broad terms, they do have a clear theory. The broad terms is that there was some kind of U.S. government conspiracy. The first thing they did is they told NORAD to stand their planes down. Then they planted explosives in the World Trade Center. The planes were either on remote control or some other advanced technology, smashed into the buildings, and then about an hour later, they blew up these bombs and the buildings came down. And they did all this as a pretext to attack Afghanistan and Iraq. And the whole thing was one big inside job so Bush and Cheney could get their wars in the Middle East. What they don't tell us, and this is what you were referring to when I say that they don't give us any details, I will ask them, how is this organized? How were the thousands of bombs required to bomb these buildings placed in the buildings? How is it that after 10 years, total secrecy has prevailed? No one in NORAD has spoken out. No one in the CIA has spoken out. Why is it that the majority of the hijackers on the aircraft were Saudis instead of Iraqis, as you would expect if this were an inside job? And they don't have answers to any of these questions. Instead, what they will tell me is, well, we're just asking skeptical questions. We're just challenging the prevailing orthodoxy. We're just doing our job as investigators. And it's actually quite maddening because you're trying to debate them, but they won't give you details about what is clearly a preposterous Hollywood movie plot, a plot that would be laughed out of any Hollywood studio, in fact, because it's so ridiculous. So instead, they will stick to these scattered talking points about NORAD and things that have been debunked, but still they will purport to make a case against the viability of the prevailing theory of 9/11. They will attempt to show that it's impossible that Al-Qaeda could have done it. These were just people living in caves. But then when you challenge them to give their own theory, they won't give you any details, perhaps because they know it will sound very ridiculous. But the whole thing makes arguing with 9/11 truthers very, very difficult. In fact, one thing I admit in the book is I've never won an argument against a conspiracy theorist because they are so committed to their narrative. As I say, it's like a secular religion, and they're committed to it with the same strength of commitment that that religious devotees attach to their religious faith. And so never once was I able to use force of logic to dislodge these people from their views.
Well, let's talk about some of the high priests of the 9/11 truth movement, as you refer to them. One of them early on that you profile in your book is the radio host Alex Jones, based in Texas, who is a person who uses his radio program to proliferate a lot of these conspiracy theories. Tell us a little bit about Alex Jones and how his personality is in many ways sort of typical of the quite intelligent and even eloquent 9/11 truther.
Yeah, I mean, he's obviously an extremely intelligent person. He grew up in Texas. He became radicalized by Waco and the Oklahoma City bombing, and he decided that a lot of these disasters were just inside jobs perpetrated by the government to challenge states' rights or whatnot. At a very early age, I think he was in his very early 20s, he became a radio host. And if you listen to his radio show, it's just one conspiracy theory after another. 9/11 is just one of them. When I interviewed him, it was actually very hard to keep up with him because in the same sentence, he might talk about JFK, black helicopters, 9/11. It was hard for me even to write it all down. And yet he has lots and lots of fans, and people listen to his show over the internet. And when I go to these 9/11 truth conferences to do reporting, many of them are wearing Alex Jones T-shirts. And yet this all happens under the radar of mainstream media for the most part. Most ordinary Americans, I'm guessing, have never heard of Alex Jones. He's a cult hero to millions of primarily young listeners, and he fills their head with conspiracy theories. But because it's mostly over the internet, on his websites and whatnot, most people have never heard of him. And this is part of a larger phenomenon where people are just going into their own isolated information silos and they don't see what other people are consuming. The media landscape has become very segmented, and that's how people like Alex Jones have been able to build little fiefdoms among their fans.
Now, it's interesting to see the political spectrum among conspiracy theorists. Not only do you talk about the 9/11 truth movement, but you also talk about the birthers in the U.S. who tend to be primarily conservative. But on the 9/11 truth movement front, where do political allegiances lie? Is it primarily a left-leaning movement, or is there a smattering of right-wing ideology in there? Where does Alex Jones fit in?
Well, that's the thing. Alex Jones is actually on the right side of the political spectrum. He's libertarian. And this is one thing that surprised me. When I started investigating the 9/11 truth phenomenon, I assumed that all of these people were left-wing readers of Noam Chomsky and that sort of thing. What I found was that, yes, there were a lot of those people, people who wanted to believe that America was responsible for all the world's evil, including 9/11. But a lot of the people were actually right-wing libertarians who believed that the 9/11 attacks were a pretext to create a police state, to deliver the United States into the hands of the United Nations, to destroy American sovereignty. It fed into all of their fears about America losing its status as an independent country and being taken over by the UN or some other supranational body like the Bilderbergers or something. And so what I concluded was that these conspiracy theories proliferate at both extremes of the political spectrum, both the radical left, the America-hating left, and the radical libertarian right. And I would put Alex Jones into the latter category.
And this is kind of strange because don't these two sides interact at the 9/11 truth conferences, or do they have their own versions?
Very interesting. They sometimes do, but in chapter 10 of my book, I think it is, I think it's the second to last chapter, I talk about the 9/11 truth conferences that I attended in 2009 in New York City. And there were two separate conferences. One was a left-wing conference. It was mostly an older crowd, mostly academics. These are sort of people with strong memories of Vietnam who, as I say, who read Noam Chomsky and Howard Zinn and are really very, very skeptical of U.S. power in every sense. And they were spouting a lot of the usual stuff And then there was this completely different conference that was held a couple of blocks away. And these were younger folks wearing Alex Jones T-shirts, wearing Ron Paul T-shirts, wearing End of the Fed T-shirts. These were noisier, more radicalized, very right-wing, very libertarian. And they had a completely different narrative. They were patriotic Americans. They were waving American flags and chanting USA, USA, USA. And their narrative was all about how the United States is such a wonderful country, but that the 9/11 conspiracists are trying, the 9/11 plotters were trying to destroy America by delivering it into the hands of the United Nations or whatnot. So two completely different narratives, one America hating, one America loving. But both of them ended up embracing the same fairy tale about 9/11.
I've been speaking with Jonathan Kay. He's a managing editor, columnist, and blogger at Canada's National Post newspaper. We've been discussing his book, Among the Truthers, A Journey Through America's Growing Conspiracist Underground. We'll be right back after the short break with part two of our interview.
Hi, this is Steve Scrovan. Join me and an all-star cast of comedians as we stand up for Main Street, a comedy benefit for Public Citizen, Sunday, June 12th at 6:30 at the beautiful Brentwood Theater. Come laugh with Bill Burr, Jeff Garland, Dom Herrera, Andy Kindler, Paula Poundstone, Hal Sparks, and Roy Zimmerman as we stand up for Main Street. For tickets, go to citizen.org and click on the Stand Up for Main Street window. That's citizen.org.
KPFK is heard on K254AH, Isla Vista, and K229BO, Rancho Bernardo.
Welcome back to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We turn back to Jonathan Kay to discuss his new book, Among the Truthers, A Journey Through America's Growing Conspiracist Underground.
What about the overarching sort of prevailing worldview of conspiracy theorists? Is there a common narrative that you found in your journey through this underground that has consistent patterns, that the vast majority of people believe in a mostly common thread of theories? Or is there just, lots of different theories with lots of overlap?
Well, as we were talking about earlier, there is a common structure, and it's been around since at least the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and that is that there is a single group controlling the world. That's why whenever you interview these people, they will always show you a flowchart, right?
And you call it flowchart conspiracism, and
right.
I have to admit I've seen several of, I've been shown several of these.
Yeah, yeah. And Glenn Beck shows these on his shows, right?
Right.
He has a George Soros at the top or some other group, and there always is some box at the top. That's the whole point of it, to show that there's this one group, sometimes they just call it the oligarchy or the financiers or the military-industrial complex. And so there's always one group, and it's secretive. That's another key component of this. So, I mean, that's why Vatican conspiracy theories, like Dan Brown stuff, is so popular, because secretive groups are always very popular with conspiracy theorists. And that this group is evil. That's the third component. It's a single group. It operates in secret, and it's not just evil, but it's evil on the scale of comic book villains. It seeks to exterminate great swaths of humanity. It'll do anything to further its plots, even fly planes into skyscrapers. Also, greed is a fourth component of this. All conspiracy theories generally revolve around the monopoly of some crucial resource. In the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, it was gold. But then that switched over to oil around the middle of the 20th century, and all modern conspiracy theories tend to revolve around the monopoly of oil. That's something that unites all conspiracy theorists, it seems, these days. And then the fifth element, which I spot in conspiracy theories, is the idea of hypercompetence, the idea that the villain isn't just evil. He's also an evil genius, the idea that he can bomb huge office buildings without getting caught. He can invent all kinds of sophisticated space weapons. He can control the world's money supply with the stroke of a pen. He can do any of these things. And as I say, get away with it, cover his tracks, completely control the media, make sure he totally gets away with it. Again, there's a sort of comic book aspect to it. And this goes across all conspiracy theories. It's universal.
Is it also universal that at the heart of most conspiracy theories there's at least a grain of truth?
Yes. I mean, almost always. For instance, there is no grain of truth beyond Holocaust denial. But 90% of conspiracy theories do have some grain of truth, even if it's just a small one. For instance, the sort of people who, let's say they have conspiracy theories about vaccines. They believe vaccines cause autism, which is not true, or they believe vaccines cause other diseases. That's wrong. But it is true that in the past, some medications we've been told to take have been bad for us, have caused deformed fetuses in pregnant women and that sort of thing. Another example is false flag operations. It is true that the Gulf of Tonkin was a very suspicious incident. It's not on par, obviously, with flying planes into skyscrapers. But there have been episodes in American history when the government has done some pretty dodgy things. You know, they can point to Watergate, for instance, or Iran-Contra. You know, these are not conspiracy theories. These are true historical episodes.
So in some ways, those grains of truth serve to legitimize these conspiracy theories so that people who do have a problem with them have a hard time combating them on this, you know, using logic.
Well, what I say is that there are suspicious bad things that happen in every society. No society is perfect. Governments always do bad things. It happens. The sign of a society that is taken over by conspiracy theories is one where people extrapolate from these isolated episodes to a pathological extent and embrace the belief that all of society is completely corrupt and the government is completely evil. So they basically take what they know about small-scale conspiracies and they amplify it by many orders of magnitude and create Hollywood-style dramas in which all of society is under threat because of these massive conspiracies.
And in fact, give our listeners some examples of what you say, because when you've attended some of these 9/11 Truth conferences, you found that a lot of the logic that's used to build the case, and you know, some of these talks can go on for hours, often they start by building up their theory based on parallels that we know the U.S. government or the CIA has this kind of a history. We know that the government isn't beyond harming its own citizens because look, it did it in that case. And then those are seen as exhibit A, B, and C, or treated in that way to then make a very large leap of faith extrapolation toward what they're building up for.
Oh yes, and this is very common in the video propaganda that is used by conspiracy theorists. And a good example is the conspiracy theorists' theories around FEMA camps. There's one popular conspiracy theory that says that the United States government is going to round up political dissidents and put them in camps run by FEMA.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency.
Right, mm-hmm. which usually is tasked with things like helping people after floods and earthquakes and that sort of thing. And I was watching one very popular film about FEMA, a conspiracy theorist film, and the first half of the film was all about the internment of Japanese during the Second World War,
mm-hmm.
which, of course, was a very real and disgraceful episode in American history. You're watching it, there's footage, it's heartrending, there's music, and as you're watching it, you're getting very angry at the U.S. government. And then all of a sudden, the film switches, and a narrator asks the question, could this happen in today's America? And suddenly they're showing us footage of FEMA building camps near New Orleans. And then the narrator is talking about documents that have passed through the legislature, which suggest that the government is going to round everybody up, and it'll be just like the Japanese internment again. And because of the way the music is scored and the video clips are presented, you actually start to believe it's true because your brain has been softened up for 20 or 30 minutes by the accurate historical footage, and you start to become suspicious of your own government. And then when someone says to you, well, why wouldn't they do it again and put millions of Americans into camps for political reasons, you start to believe it. And then you shake yourself and say, this is ridiculous. You know, FEMA could barely save a few thousand people in New Orleans. They certainly don't have the resources to put millions of political dissidents in camps, and obviously there'd be a massive outrage by it, and there's a million reasons why it couldn't happen today. And yet you become credulous because that little grain of truth from the World War II era softens up your mind, and you start to think that this wide-scale conspiracy could actually unfold in 2011.
Let me ask you a personal question, if you don't mind. You talked about in the beginning of your book how, in many ways, you felt like many of the 9/11 truthers and conspiracy theorists were, consumed obsessively by an issue in the way you yourself have found yourself being consumed by, some kind of often an intellectual exercise, et cetera. Did you ever wonder yourself, did you ever come to a point where you thought, my goodness, could they be telling the truth about something?
No, I didn't. However, I did become very conscious that the methods of thought that were going into their conspiracy theories are more common than I suspected.
Hmm.
I think everybody bends the logic of reality in certain ways in order to reinforce certain ideological biases they have. And I see this all the time. Today I was writing an article about Israel. This isn't an issue people feel passionately about. And I see people on both sides taking leaps from reality and bending the rules of logic to support their point of view. It happens with global warming, too. I mean, you have Republicans who just will deny the settled science on global warming because it does not fit in with their world of view. They take the same attitude toward creationism. On the left, you see the same pattern sometimes with radical environmentalists. So writing the book has made me conscious of the ways that humans, not just conspiracy theorists, bend logic in all sorts of ways, and it's made me a little bit more careful about the way I monitor my own thoughts, because I realize that this is a trap that we can all fall into once in a while.
Well, let's talk about the other aspect of how the extrapolations are done to make the case for various conspiracies. You discuss in your book the question that's often brought up by conspiracists is who benefits? And, you know, certainly that's a useful question to ask for anybody trying to investigate a certain story, but how does that question get taken perhaps a little too far?
Yes, they prefer the Latin formulation, which is qui bono, which sounds fancier and more erudite. And this goes back all the way to the French Revolution. Because one of the arguments that was made by conspiracy theorists that the Jews caused the French Revolution was that the Jews, for a brief time, were treated much better after the French Revolution than they were before. So under the logic of qui bono, who benefits, it was thought, well, the Jews benefited, so therefore it must have been their revolution. And the same is true today. Regarding 9/11, the conspiracy theorists will say, well, the neocons got their war against Afghanistan and they got their war against Iraq. Therefore, they benefited. Therefore, they engineered 9/11. The problem with this logic, of course, is it could support all sorts of crazy inferences. History is very complicated, and all sorts of people benefit in all kinds of direct and indirect ways from every historical event. If you tallied up all the people who benefited or did not benefit from any particular historical incident, you'd have thousands of alleged evildoers. But it's a very popular form of reasoning in the conspiracist community. And as I say, it's been around for several hundred years.
Let's talk about the birthers, the conservative conspiracists of today, very closely linked with the Tea Party movement, very much, the sort of traditional patriotic, pro-America and pro-capitalist perspective. Did the election of President Obama have the same effect on conservative conspiracy theorists that the 9/11 attacks may have had on progressive or left-wing conspiracy theorists?
It's roughly analogous. I don't want to read too much into it, but mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, look, the difference is that in the case of 9/11 conspiracy theorists, I found they were on both sides. I found radical
sure.
leftists and radical rightists. In the case of birthers, Barack Obama birthers, I only found right-wing conspiracy theorists.
And just in case there's somebody out there who doesn't know what we're talking about, birthers are people who believe that President Obama was not actually born in the United States, which would disqualify him from being president.
Yes, and typically they believe he was born in Kenya or, in some cases, Indonesia. And I have never found a left-wing birther. There may be one bizarre specimen out there, but I have never met a left-wing person who believes that Obama was born in Kenya. The birthers generally are people who, and I've interviewed a bunch of them, they're people who are politically traumatized by the result of the 2008 election. and they have never been able to psychologically reconcile themselves with a left of center president. Many people on the left think that it's a racist phenomenon. I actually don't think it's primarily a racist phenomenon. I think it's primarily a political phenomenon. Birthers simply cannot digest the fact that America no longer has a right-wing president, and they have created a fantasy world that allows them to reconcile their ideology with the reality. And so,
but we have had Democratic presidents not too long ago. I mean, why didn't we see this sort of phenomenon when Clinton was president, or did we?
To a certain extent, you did. Mm-hmm. But what's happened is the internet effect is so much more pronounced now.
Hmm.
And in the Clinton era, I think a majority of middle-aged Americans, the sort of people who have become birthers, white, middle-aged, right-leaning Americans, these people were still getting their news from conventional media. And what's happened is, in the last decade or so, you have not just young people, but now middle-aged Americans are now, in many cases, getting most or all of their news online. And that has had a radicalizing effect on the marketplace of ideas, because people like me in the mainstream media, we no longer act as filters for these people. So instead, they get all their news from right-wing websites, which in some cases simply just peddle nonsense. The example I always give is WorldNet Daily, which is WND.com, which is formerly a respectable news site, but now is more or less just 100% birther conspiracy theories. And many of the people I interviewed just get all their news from WND. And as a result, their entire media universe is composed of other conspiracy theorists. And this is something that just didn't exist 10 or 15 years ago, because people got at least some of their news from the mainstream media. So there was some filter on the sort of stuff they were reading.
I'm speaking with Jonathan Kay about his book, Among the Truthers, A Journey Through America's Growing Conspiracist Underground. What is the intersection, if any, between the birther and the truther movement? Are the right-wing conspiracists most likely to espouse both theories?
There are some birther truthers. The most awful example was the octogenarian. I forget his name, but he was the one who shot the prison guard at the Holocaust Museum in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
He turned out to be a birther and a truther. You actually often get people who believe many different conspiracy theories, and this goes to the internet phenomenon we were just discussing. What happens is that a person will be radicalized by one conspiracy theory. He'll go onto the internet to some website or other, and that website will have all sorts of links to other conspiracist websites. And in just a few days of web surfing, he'll follow the trail of links, and he'll become indoctrinated in half a dozen different conspiracy theories. Which is why I consider conspiracism as sort of a creed, because many of these people, it's not just one or two theories they believe. Their whole worldview is shaped by conspiracism. And this is one of the effects of the internet. It's put different groups of conspiracy theorists in touch with one another, which, again, this didn't exist a generation ago. That's why a generation ago maybe people stuck to one or two little conspiracy theories as hobbies. Whereas now, because of the internet, it takes over their entire life.
Let's talk about some of the other theories that are out there. I mean, you know, there's the 9/11 truth movement, but then we have the sort of UFO conspiracists, people who believe that the AIDS epidemic was man-made as a racist genocidal tool. There's also the theory that the H1N1 virus was man-made. How much credence do these theories have? Are they as widespread as the 9/11 truth movement?
Yes, in certain communities they are, and it's quite tragic because the belief that AIDS was man-made by the U.S. government in order to kill black people is especially popular in the black community. And unfortunately, they've done studies. There's a correlation between belief in that conspiracy theory and also belief that AIDS drugs are dangerous. And so what happens is the same people who believe that AIDS is a man-made toxin also believe that they shouldn't take their drugs, which is why a disproportionate number of blacks often don't take their antiretroviral medication and are at increased risk of mortality. That's a case in which conspiracy theories actually quite literally can kill you.
Hmm. I want to talk about the fact that there are many very, very high-profile conspiracy theorists as well out there who perhaps may give some legitimacy to some of these theories, from people like Jesse Ventura to Hugo Chavez, Ahmadinejad, the Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad. What role do these people who have, you know, who are some of them elected, in fact, the ones that I all mentioned, elected officials, heads of state, some of them, do they play a role in legitimizing these theories?
Yes, they do. And I think people say, well, if someone who's a head of state or a former head of state believes it, there must be some credence in it. You also have other people, like people who appear on Fox News have spouted 9/11 conspiracy theories.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie Sheen is a 9/11 truther. I mean, I don't think people take Sheen particularly seriously now, but he was spouting these theories a year or two ago when I think he still had some credibility. Richard Falk, who was the United Nations rapporteur at one point for Israel.
Really?
Yeah, he's a truther. In fact, he wrote the introduction to David Ray Griffin's conspiracy theory book on the subject, which is called The New Pearl Harbor, one of the most influential 9/11 truth books out there. And if you open up your edition, if you have one, you'll see a preface by Richard Falk, one-time esteemed academic and UN official.
I think I've interviewed him.
Yeah, well, next time you have him on the show, you should ask him who blew up the World Trade Center. He might have some interesting opinions on that.
So I want to talk now about the psychology, the sort of reason why you think these theories catch people's imagination. We know why how it is that they're getting proliferated so easily. The internet plays a big role. But what is it about the sort of psyche or psychological trauma that people experience when catastrophes like 9/11 happen, or when, you know, the earth-shaking things like the election of President Obama happen? Are conspiracy theories a way to bring into alignment our understanding of this big, very complex, hard-to-understand world?
Yes, and the way they do it is by eliminating cognitive dissonance, which is the dissonance between what we believe and what we see. All of us have ideologies, and it hurts our brain when those ideologies are contradicted by world events. So if you are an America hater and you believe America has a monopoly on evil, and then 9/11 comes along and it's an evil act perpetrated not by America but against America, your brain instinctively looks for a theory that brings your ideology into line with the facts. And that's where 9/11 conspiracy theories come from, on the left at least, because these are people who have created a fantasy that allows them to hang on to their ideology. The same is true of Islamists who can't believe that Muslims would do anything as horrible as fly planes into skyscrapers, and they simply refuse to believe that it was Muslims who did this. And as I say, the same is true of birthers. If you believe America is a right-wing country and that patriotic Americans would never vote for a guy like Barack Obama, you will cling to a fantasy that says that the election was fraudulent and a hoax because Obama is an illegitimate presidential candidate. And that fantasy allows you to hang on to the myths you have about America and reconcile that with the result of the 2008 election. It allows you to cling to this fantasy that says that if you just argue this point hard enough, eventually people will listen to you and history will be corrected, that we can go back in time and correct history. Traumatic events in history cause people to reach for fantastic explanations for why things happen.
I want to ask you about a couple of new things that have cropped up since your book was written. One, of course, is the murder of Osama bin Laden by American Navy SEALs, which spawned conspiracy theories practically from the moment the news came out, either that he wasn't really killed or that he was killed long before, or that the U.S. had known for years that where he was before killing him. Anything that you've discovered about that incident that is either in line with or out of line with what you know about conspiracy theories?
Oh, well, right after that was that, right after Obama announced the death of Osama bin Laden, I immediately went onto the internet and looked at some of the 9/11 conspiracy websites. And what I found is that they almost immediately had responded by posting their theories about what had happened. Of course,
before knowing any information.
Yeah, I mean, from the get-go, these are sites where the people had assumed that Osama bin Laden had nothing to do with 9/11.
Right,
and to
right.
the extent Osama bin Laden even existed as a real person, they thought it was either in a Los Angeles studio or he was a creation of the CIA.
And it helped their case that his body wasn't presented or photos weren't presented by the U.S. government to the public.
That's true, but even had photos been made public, I don't think that would have had any effect. In the same way that when Barack Obama made public his so-called long-form birth certificate, if you go to the hardcore birther conspiracy websites, they all assume it's fake. They have these very detailed, arcane, pixel-by-pixel analyses that purport to prove that it was manipulated in some way. As I say, this is very much like a religion. And in the same way that you cannot prove to someone that their religious faith is wrong, you cannot successfully prove to a conspiracy theorist that his theories are wrong.
Well, there's a new one that's been floating out there. I don't know if you've seen it, that the Earth is going to be swallowed up by a solar flare next year, and that scientists are holding back information to prevent mass panic. There's an article on a website called gather.com entitled, "Is NASA Hiding 2012 Doomsday Evidence?" Have you heard of this?
No, but this is certainly in keeping with the whole batch of millennial theories that, I mean, the most famous, of course, was the May 21 theory, which proved, thankfully, to be false.
The rapture?
Yeah, the rapture, which didn't come.
Well, you would characterize that as a conspiracy theory?
No, I don't, because it's just a straightforward religious hoax.
Mm-hmm.
But prophecies of apocalyptic destruction tend to go hand in hand with conspiracy theories, because they both imagine a confrontation between good and evil that will end with an apocalyptic, catastrophic climax. And the millennial mythology supplies the detail about what will actually happen, but the conspiracy theory part of it supplies the idea of who the evildoers are behind this coming apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of religious adherents, they typically imagine it's Satan or the Antichrist or something like that. In the case of secular conspiracy theorists, they will imagine some more earthly Antichrist figure like the Bilderbergers or something.
Well, I'm wondering if you have thought about this, and I don't even know if you can answer this, but I noticed as reading your book, why are most of the leading conspiracy theorists men?
That's a very good question.
I noticed there were like almost no women.
I'll be candid about this, but it might sound slightly sexist. Even though I think there are very few women who would begrudge the fact that there are a few female conspiracy theorists. Conspiracy theories are very technical businesses. Most of the people I interviewed spent 10, 12, 14 hours a day in front of a computer looking at very arcane, esoteric information. One guy I interviewed, for instance, spent hours and hours just analyzing the tail fin numbers of the planes used on 9/11. And then he broadened it out and he analyzed the tail fin numbers of every plane that was in the air on 9/11. And this is just a project that took weeks and weeks. It was unbelievably tedious. For reasons I do not fully understand, this kind of Asperger's type obsession with technical details seems to be mostly a male fixation.
Of these men that you talk to have lost so much personally doing this. They've been sucked into this and lost, you know, family, jobs, etc.
Well, what's happened is their social world has gone completely online. So in many cases, yes, they've lost touch with real-life loved ones, and their social community now is completely composed of people they meet online who share their beliefs. This is a form of pathological social behavior that, for one reason or another, appeals much more to men than to women. Most women I know require more in the way of real-life social contact. The other aspect is that many conspiracy theorists retreat into sort of an adolescent world of space weapons and secret decoder rings and the world of spies and spooks. And if you go to these conventions, sometimes they'll give speeches about how 9/11 might have happened. And it sounds like a bad adolescent attempt at a Hollywood action movie. And for reasons that maybe you understand more than I do, this has very limited fascination for most women. In fact, when I go to these conventions, often the only women I see are bored-looking girlfriends of their boyfriends who have brought them there.
Hmm. Well, finally, do conspiracy theorists like being called conspiracy theorists, or is that a derogatory term from their perspective that you found?
It's a derogatory term. They don't like it, just like they don't like anything else about my book.
Hmm.
And, you know, I knew going in that they wouldn't like the book, but I wrote this for the rest of us.
You say you think your book will do little to change the mind of truthers.
It will do very little to change the mind of people who are already conspiracy theorists. Because as I say, you can't win an argument with someone who already has become a conspiracy theorist. Where I think it might be helpful is for people who have not yet become conspiracy theorists and to teach them the psychological elements in these conspiracy theories and, if you will, to help inoculate them against this sort of thing so that when they see a YouTube video or their friend sends them to a website where these conspiracy theories are being cited, that they will recognize them for what they are. And they won't think that this is some kind of wonderful truth that they've stumbled upon.
I've been speaking with Jonathan Kay about his book, Among the Truthers, A Journey Through America's Growing Conspiracist Underground. If you've enjoyed this interview, if you've hated it, if you disagree or agree with what you've heard today, feel free to leave comments on our website at uprisingradio.org. Remember to be respectful and not too lengthy. No personal attacks or name-calling. For Sonali Subversive Thought for the Day, leading prosecutor Vincent Bugliosi once said, "The conspiracy community regularly seizes on one slip of the tongue, misunderstanding, or slight discrepancy to defeat 20 pieces of solid evidence, accepts one witness of theirs, even if he or she is a provable nut, as being far more credible than 10 normal witnesses on the other side, treats rumors, even questions, as the equivalent of proof, leaps from the most minuscule of discoveries to the grandest of conclusions, and insists that the failure to explain everything perfectly negates all that is explained." That's Vincent Bugliosi. That's Anali's Subversive Thought for the Day. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our assistant producer. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can order a copy of today's show at 1-800-735-0230 or at pacificaradioarchives.org. Listen to the show online. Find links, local events, and other information at uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kohatkar. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow at 8.